This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad, and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 15 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today is part 2 in our series on J.J. Abrams, looking at his feature films as a director, where we are going to be looking at his first movie, Mission Impossible 3. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And we are joined today by Tisto of Tisto.com. How's it going, Tisto?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it. Now, you're in the middle of a Mission Impossible series on your show, right?
That's right, yeah. I did Mission Impossible commentary, and then you helped me out with a Mission Impossible 2 commentary, and I'm about to do a Mission Impossible 3 commentary, and then eventually a Mission Impossible...
Ghost Protocol.
Before, right? Yes, Ghost Protocol. And then... presumably 5 whenever that comes out.
Yeah, 5 is supposed to come out, I think, Christmas Day 2015.
I like how I pretended to forget the name of the movie, and then I actually forgot the name of the movie?
That was pretty good. for those people who don't know, I mean, your show is primarily audio commentaries, or exclusively audio commentaries, right?
Yes, if you can call it a podcast, yeah, it is a podcast where every episode is a audio commentary of a movie or television show, yeah.
Yeah, and these are some really good audio commentaries, you know, very, very, you know, funny and fun, but also extremely well thought out and informative.
Well, you try to actually talk about the movie that you're watching.
Yeah.
Which I feel is an error.
I do.
But it's not just like trivia and stuff like that. Like there's a lot of like hardcore analysis going on, which is,
sure.
is really solid.
Yeah,
so.
It is. It is very solid.
Yeah. So definitely go to Tisto.com, T-Y-S-T-O.com, and check out some of Tisto's stuff because it's great. Okay. My cat's running around like an idiot now, so... All right, so since we're talking about J.J. Abrams in general, this series, Tisto, what are your thoughts on J.J. Abrams? Are you a fan? Have you seen his shows and his other movies, or not so much?
I am a fan, I have to say. I did not get sucked into Lost. I kind of saw that that was probably going to go down a rabbit hole that it could not get out of very early on. But I did love Fringe. And stuck with it to the very end, even though it kind of went down a rabbit hole of its own, but I think it kind of crawled out. His movies, I think, have been more hit or miss for me, and I find them to be thrilling, generally speaking, but not always, somehow not always holding together very well, particularly logically.
They weren't very good, in particular, All the Ways That Matter.
Well, what about his Star Trek movies? Were you a fan of Star Trek 09 and Star Trek Into Darkness?
It's weird. I'm a guy who absolutely loves a tight script that makes good sense, and that movie, nothing about it made any sense at all. And I still...
The first one or the second
He's talking
one?
About both.
The first one. Well, I haven't actually seen Star Trek Into Darkness because I didn't care for Star Trek in the first place. So I haven't been in a hurry to watch the second one. But nevertheless, I found it thrilling. I do find it entertaining. It's just not very good Star Trek.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So this movie is Mission Impossible 3, like we said. It's Abrams' first film. It came out in 2006. So the way that the story goes, apparently, is that J.J. Abrams met Tom Cruise, who knows where, at a party or something like that.
Those guys schmooze together all the time, you know it.
Yeah, and they were talking, and they're talking about Alias or whatever, and Tom Cruise is like, hey, I haven't seen Alias yet. And J.J. was like, oh, well, I'll send you seasons 1 and 2. And Tom Cruise is like, all right, cool. And he watches them eventually.
As I understand it, Katie Holmes was with him during this viewing experience.
Well, maybe it was. I don't know if the timeline was lined up there.
I think that's how I heard the story.
Okay, well, regardless. Mission Impossible 3, for those who don't know, was initially going to be directed by Joe Carnahan. And it was going to be about something completely different. It was going to involve blood diamonds and Kenneth Branagh. I think Scarlett Johansson was in there somewhere. And basically, this thing just completely fell apart. And then, sort of out of desperation, Tom Cruise is like, hey, JJ, you're really good at making spy things. What would you think about making Mission Impossible 3? And JJ said, that sounds like a great idea, but if I'm going to do it, I think probably the way to go about it, the way to go about, quote-unquote, saving this movie would be to start from scratch and just write a whole different movie and just start up things, you know, on and go a completely different direction.
It's the best way to save things.
Yes.
To not.
Just throw them out the window.
I agree.
Yeah.
So JJ brought on Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orsi, who were two writers who had worked with him on Alias. And the three of them crafted this movie. And it came out in 2006, and everyone at the studio was very impressed by it and impressed by how, you know, Abrams had essentially turned around a franchise in trouble. And they said, hey, we've got another franchise which is in trouble, and that's Star Trek. And why don't you try to do what you just did with Mission Impossible, but with Star Trek? So that's kind of the origin, and one of the reasons why Mission Impossible 3, for better or worse, depending on your perspective, is a really big piece of the Star Trek puzzle.
Was Star Trek foundering at that moment? And did they actually have like a bad script that he threw out and made a worse one? Or how did that work?
No, Star Trek wasn't a thing at that point. Your version of the story is very pro Abrams, and you're sort of ignoring the business side of it.
Well, I mean, the business side, the non-business side, whatever.
He had been inside for a long time, and was considered kind of.
It is one of those things.
A staple, a standby. He's always been there. He was always working on scripts.
He was always working on scripts. He had never really made his own movie. He had never really and shepherded his own movie.
But he'd been credited with saving a lot of movies.
Well, maybe.
And
but
by
he had never,
saving, like, they still made money.
But not on this huge scale. But he was sort of known as a presence, and his work on TV was so well-received that he was considered to be kind of a filmmaker himself. I mean, like, even so much so that I think the commentary that Abrams and Cruise do for this movie, you know, Cruise is like, oh, this is your first movie, you know, it's pretty good for your first movie, or he says that. One of them kind of jokes about that, and then they sort of laugh like, yeah, this is your first movie, you know, as if, like, you've never done this before, when in reality he has done this before.
Well,
just
yeah,
in different places.
No matter how big Tom Cruise is, he would not have been able to get J.J. Abrams to direct this movie if the studio did not already think that he was fairly safe.
Right. And
he was more of a producer than anything else, right? He'd done some producing of movies rather than directing.
Yeah, but
he had directed some directing for TV.
Yeah.
He had just won the Emmy for directing the pilot for Lost, which was the most expensive pilot in history and everything. So that was practically a movie in and of itself. But in terms of, like, did he save a script? Did he throw something out? I'm not really sure if he threw something out, but there was certainly another script which existed prior to this that they were at one point planning on doing for Star Trek, and it was involving the Romulan War. And it was written by Eric Gendrison, who wrote Band of Brothers.
But as it is with a lot of behind-the-scenes studio politics stuff, we don't really know the entire story there. And largely it's because there probably was a lot more going on.
There definitely was a lot more going on. Like, Rick Berman was on board as a producer, but later on, Gendrison said that Berman was a producer in name only and literally did no work on that movie whatsoever. You know, things like that. Who knows exactly?
The studio politics thing, it's half legend and half myth.
Yeah.
There's no actual history there.
But it is interesting nonetheless. But regardless, I don't think that JJ had anything to do with that. I think what they said was, JJ, we would like you to do Star Trek. What are your ideas for Star Trek? And I think he said, well, I definitely want to do something with the original series crew. And then they went from there. But regardless, we're talking about what happened before that, I guess, which is Mission Impossible 3. It came out in 2006. And it featured a lot of people who would later go on to work on Star Trek, obviously, but we can get into that later. So now, before we actually talk about the movie itself, let's talk about Mission Impossible as kind of a franchise. Now, Tisto, you're pretty familiar with the original series. You've seen a good chunk of it.
Yeah, the first couple of seasons, anyway. Yeah, it went on for several seasons. But and changed quite a bit over time, but it didn't change very much in terms of its structure.
Mm-hmm. And what were your thoughts on it?
It was terrific. I had only seen one episode of the TV show before I saw the first movie in '96, and I knew that they had, you know, veered away from it quite a lot. But in revisiting the TV show, I just fell in love with it until I realized that really every episode was just too much of the same thing over and over again. So I don't, in principle, I don't blame Cruise and his coworkers for changing it up a bit, but I do blame them for making them too generic and too similar to each other, unfortunately, which I think we'll talk about.
Okay. That's an interesting take on it, because I kind of have the opposite reaction to that, but
what, from Mission Impossible?
Yeah.
Really?
Now I've seen I watched the pilot for the original series prior to this, and one of the things that I thought was kind of weird about it, and I don't know if this is just kind of a pilot, or I got the impression this is kind of how most of it goes, is it really is like there's a mission, we need to accomplish this mission. And now we're going to watch see how they accomplish this mission.
Yeah, the pilot.
And that's really like all there is to it.
Yeah, it's the pilot, right? That's the one where they wear masks and they fool some guys and then they steal something, I think, right?
Oh, I get what you're saying.
I mean, like, was there anything in the way of like character or development or anything like that in this show?
Not in the first couple of seasons, which is really too bad, because there were cast changes, and you would expect that would be a great opportunity to actually, you know, make good on the threat of the idea that the secretary would disavow the team if something went wrong and so on. And people could have got killed and then replaced, but they didn't really do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's from the time. There wasn't a lot of character development in general. I mean, they had character moments.
Yeah.
But your characters couldn't really change.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's sort of a trap.
Okay. What about you, Max? You see some of the show?
I've seen a lot of it, actually. Like, I don't remember exactly when it happened, but at some point I discovered it in reruns when I was a kid, and I watched a big chunk of it. I think it might have been around the time they made that second one.
Mm-hmm. Like in the 80s or something?
Yeah, yep. I think that's when I started watching the original one. But I enjoyed it as much as a lot of other things, but like what stuck out in my head was that it really was sort of like it was the main course of this show that you got every night was a twist. And when you get the twist that's the same week after week, it becomes really hard to call it a twist. It became sort of like, which one of these characters is going to turn out to be another person wearing a face that's not their face? Mm-hmm. And that was sort of a thing.
It was a procedural, and
yes,
like any police procedural, it can get old, yeah.
So moving on to the movies, you know, in 1996, Paramount decided to adapt Mission Impossible for the big screen, starring Tom Cruise and everything like that. And the movies are, I think, probably what most people today kind of associate with Mission Impossible, for better or worse. Tista, what are your thoughts on the movies in general? Do you like them?
Correct answer.
Right, yes. There are things I like about them, but especially the first couple, I don't know. The first one I kind of don't like. The second one I like for weird reasons that I explained in the commentary we did. This one I kind of like almost, I almost completely like it. And the fourth one is okay.
Okay. All right. Yeah. What about you, Max?
I don't really have very strong feelings about any of them. I mean, like, two is actually kind of a mess. But it's a mess in a way that is sort of normal. Like, I don't really consider it to be an outlier. It's sort of normal bad. Like most action movies, it's bad. The only problem with it is that the John Woo influence is a little silly, because it kind of feels like John Woo's just sort of, like, I mean, I don't know. It's like a weird reunion tour thing. Like, he's going back on tour after being retired for 20 years, and it's like, look, you remember the guys with the guns pointing
doves
at the
remember
faces?
The doves
I oh my god it's like ah oh, this I love this I like the original cut version though. This B-side is weird. Like, that's what it's like. It feels very awkward, but aside from that, it's just a normal bad movie. And Mission Impossible 3, I thought, wow, they sort of like mastered this format of like an action movie that sort of just exists and then is meaningless. Essentially, it's disposable, but like the perfect disposable story. I mean, it's perfectly timed so that when you walk out of that room, you're like, that was thrilling. And then 5 minutes later, you have no idea what you were talking about because it left absolutely no impression on you. Except apparently for you.
Oh, yeah.
Because I instantaneously moved on from that movie. Because, you know, it's kind of simple. And that's about it. And that's okay. There are plenty of bad movies that are just bad because they're kind of simple.
I think there's a lot going on beneath the surface, but we'll get into that in a second. For me personally, with the movies in general, and this is sort of like where my knowledge of Mission Impossible comes from, you know, I've always been a fan of the movies. I've always been very excited whenever a new one comes out. I went to see the first one at the sneak preview the night before it came out and everything. Been a fan ever since. And one of the things which I sort of love about them is, unlike a lot of movie franchises where they have a cohesive style and everything like that, and they feel like they're all part of one giant movie, each one of these is directed by a different person, and each one, like, unabashedly assumes the style of that particular director and doesn't even necessarily try to match or fit in with what has come before. It's almost like an anthology series of movies with this one character who is quote unquote the same, even though I really do think, especially if you're looking at like the first and the second one, it's essentially a completely different character with just the same name played by the same guy. But because of that,
I don't know who you're refuting right now, but I don't think it's anyone in the room.
I'm agreeing.
I'm not,
okay.
Yeah. So, you know, Mission Impossible 3, you know, I was really looking forward to, and when I saw it, it actually did blow me away. I was very, very impressed by it. Now, let's move into Mission Impossible 3 itself and sort of get into
the
heart of that. Like I was saying, I was a fan of the series, and I was also a fan of J.J. Abrams. I had seen all of Alias, and I was very impressed by that. And this was during that weird year of my life where I decided to not watch any trailers or read anything about movies, just go into everything blind. So I hadn't seen any of like the big trailer moments, which, you know, everyone else had sort of already been impressed by. I was sort of experiencing it all fresh.
Or annoyed by.
And I hadn't I didn't really have any expectations aside from my love of the Mission Impossible movies and my love of J.J. Abrams.
This is the year of the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie. The Da Vinci Code, Casino Royale, the first Casino Royale.
Casino Royale, yes.
The new Bond. Cars.
Okay, so it wasn't all bad.
X-Men 3.
Okay, maybe I was wrong.
Superman Returns.
Superman Returns. Right. Yeah, that was the big. But I remember, you know, Casino Royale was a big one, and Clerks 2 was the other thing that I was really looking forward to.
Yep, those were the two major hits of the summer.
Those were the two. No.
Those were the ones that I was really looking forward to anyway. But regardless, so yeah, when I saw this, I was really impressed by it for a lot of reasons. One, you know, just as far as the sort of spectacle of the summer blockbuster, I think that it did a very good job of capturing what I love about, you know, seeing movies on the big screen and everything like that. And I thought the action set pieces were really well done and everything. But I also think that it did a really good job of telling this sort of small personal story through or in the big action movie genre, which is something which Abrams seems to do really well. I mean, he did it again, I think, in Star Trek 09 and everything like that. But I also think that it's interesting as a first movie because it really does seem to build on what he had been developing in his television work and on Alias. It's a very interesting companion piece to Alias in that, you know, Alias, and they talked about this a lot of times, in the same way that Fringe is sort of an update of the X-Files, Alias, mm-hmm. I think in a lot of ways, was an update of Mission Impossible. You know, it had the same sort of formula, double agents, you know, and whatever, secret agents, undercover, in disguise, trying to pull off these crazy heists, you know, week after week. But, like, in the process of the update, you know, and obviously there was, like, a 40-year gap in between the two, or a 35-year gap, you know, the medium had obviously advanced, and the storytelling in the medium had advanced, and it was a continuing storyline. And, you know, kind of similar to, from what I understand, you know, Abrams' first series, you know, which is Felicity, is very sort of character-driven and has a lot of, it has to do with a lot of, you know, sort of like family relationships and stuff like that. And
Time travel.
And that storyline is, to me, just as interesting as all of the spy stuff. And sort of what I love about this movie and Alias and their connection is, you know, Alias is an update of Mission Impossible. Then they hire the guy who did Alias to make Mission Impossible 3, and essentially in Mission Impossible 3, what he's doing is making a big screen version of Alias. You know, there were a lot of elements from Alias which were brought into Mission Impossible 3.
That, and he's also kind of making a remake of Mission Impossible 1.
In a sense, I guess. I
mean, some unfortunate similarities.
This narrative is wildly distorted from actual history.
Well, this is what I'm seeing as an observer.
The winners write the history books, Max.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, now.
So I guess it doesn't matter what actually happened.
Let me get through this and then.
So I guess JJ's won.
I mean,
So it doesn't matter.
To me, he has won.
He basically didn't even show up for the battle.
To me, he has won. But, you know, let me get through this and then, you know.
No, he's won. He's won. I mean, he's running it. He's become the king.
I think
now.
He's already making okay. his own version of Saving Mr. Banks, in which he plays himself doing exactly this. It's a semi-documentary where he decides on the history.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair enough. So, okay, let me get through this sort of what my interpretation of events or analysis of this thing is, and then you guys can tell me how I'm wrong. With Mission Impossible 3, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, things like the family storyline and, you know, dealing with having a relationship when you're, you know, undercover and when you're in this, you know, this lifestyle, which does not permit that. You know, it's dealing with that, those types of issues. I mean, I just watched the pilot for Alias again, and I was struck by how similar the two storylines were. They go in different, you know, directions, and by creating those similarities and the similarities to in terms of the sort of procedural elements as well, I think what this ends up doing is, for one thing, reinforcing the sort of individual movie auteur theory, which is present in the Mission Impossible movies, but it also sort of does a good job of showcasing the strengths and weaknesses of television versus film. You know, and I've always talked about this, and it's like there are some things which TV does better. For example, telling storylines, you know, and in character-driven pieces and stuff like that. Whereas, of course, there's some things which the big screen does better, like, you know, huge action set pieces and everything. And I think it's cool to see the same basic story told by the same guy in each of these two media. And that type of stuff, you know, really excites me, and it's one of the reasons why I think that Mission Impossible 3 is the best film of 2006. So, okay, Tisto, why do you say that this is kind of an unfortunate remake of Mission Impossible 1?
My biggest problem with the first three films here is that in all three of them, the bad guy is an insider. That was very prevalent at the time. The bad guy was an insider in GoldenEye and some of the other following James Bond movies. In Skyfall, he's an insider who has come back to haunt them. And it's really bizarre that they would make Jim Phelps the bad guy of the first movie when he was obviously the hero of the TV show. And then in the second movie, or in the third movie, rather, come back to that and basically do that same thing again. Like, let's have his boss be the bad guy, and let's have even more boss stuff in here. It's a really strange and unfortunate way to go about making a movie that is you're trying to be different every time by hiring a different director with different styles.
I also don't think that was intentional. I mean, every time they made one of these, there was talk of another one being made by the same people, and then something fell apart, and they went a different way.
That is true, but
I don't think that they ever thought, like, let's do it different each time. I think every time it was like, that fell completely apart.
Right. No, I think you're right about that. You know, I mean, they may have, because I do remember them saying, like, oh, yeah, John Woo, we're hoping that he comes back for Mission Impossible 3, but I like the fact that they didn't do, like what they did with Brett Ratner on X-Men 3, where it's like, okay, Brett Ratner, now do your best to be
Bryan Singer.
And it's like, no, you can't do that. You've got to let Brett Ratner be Brett Ratner, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
We don't have to do anything. The other part of the thing that bothers me is that in this movie, like in the first movie, they decide, oh, in order to solve this, we have to actually steal the thing the bad guy wants and give it to him. And then we'll, you know, we'll track him, and then we'll get him.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same as the first movie.
I guess that's true. Yeah, but those are to me like surface level comparisons, and not really sort of what the movie's about or anything like that. And I think that you know, sort of the heart of the story is really strong in Mission Impossible 3. And I think that
you're talking
the
about
way
the romance. It's mush and impossible. Yes.
Also, you know, I think that the story is told a lot better. You know?
I agree with you. Absolutely, yes.
Now, Tisto, in general, do you still like this movie? I mean, it sounds like you think it's the best of the four.
I think I do, yeah. I think that it's the best of the four. I was thrilled with it in the theater because I was really quite lukewarm on the first two. And I think in true J.J. Abrams style, it's absolutely thrilling. And credit to Orson Kurtzman, who I don't care for a lot of the time. I think that the story pretty much holds water. I think Max is correct in that it doesn't amount to anything. You walk out and you go, I can't remember the plot. I remember they did some stuff.
They were getting thing,
yeah.
And there was that guy.
I remember
he wasn't particularly unattractive. Yeah,
but you remember, you know, the story between him and his wife, right?
That's, sure.
Oh,
yes.
It's so intricate. See, this is the thing. Like, this is the same criticism in Star Trek. It's like, you're like, they did a great job with this personal story. And I'm like, yeah, it's a five-minute story. It's not complicated or deep. It's actually kind of cliche. Like, this has been around for a long time. It's been done a million times. And the idea that you're saying that this thing that is kind of rote is what makes this thing so good, when the thing in question is actually kind of sort of just fast-paced, flashy action.
Well, I think there's a give and take there. You know, I think that story, you know, gives this fast-paced, flashy action movie heart and gives you something to think about and everything like that.
I don't think it, but that's the thing. It doesn't give you something to think about.
Well, I mean, I would disagree. I think that it does.
They try really hard. I mean, Luther talks again and again about how, you know, we can't have real relationships and stuff like that. Yeah.
I mean, look, here's the thing. It didn't work in Attack of the Clones. It didn't work in literally every time this has ever been done. It's a simple thing, and I don't have a problem with this plot line existing because, I mean, like, it's a reasonable thing. It happens in the world. This conflict occurs. But it's not, like, there's no magic here. There's no revelation. There's not even, like, a particularly earnest depiction of the conflict. That is the thing that makes him not just a bipedal organism who can fire guns. That's, like, essentially the only function that it has in this movie. And it's simple. And, like, it is true of... I mean, it's true of all of J.J. Abrams' movies, except for probably the one that most people find the most frustrating, Super 8. There's actually a little bit more going on there.
Okay, well, I mean, I disagree, or maybe I'm simple-minded. But regardless, I do think that there is a lot of sort of, you know, just the conflict there, which is presented in the story, the idea of sort of having to take it down to a more pedestrian level, balance your work life with your personal life, and trying to set priorities and realizing what's truly important and all this stuff. I think that's all, you know, perfectly valid. And I like the fact that, unlike most movies which deal with this subject matter, I like the fact that this one is told through giant action set pieces, which are really, really well crafted and fun to watch.
Okay, see, that's the thing. I think that those giant action set pieces, like in any action movie, I mean, like, I've seen a million action movies, and I can tell you this, like, no matter how well crafted they are boring if it is not motivated. See, and, like, there is a huge amount of unmotivated action sequences in most action movies.
That may be true. In this one, I don't think that's true. And I think that there is something to be said for, you know, the idea of action movies as storytelling, and each action set piece being its own mini movie with its own, you know, story arc and everything like that. You know, I mean, that's something that you hear people talk about all the time, and how, you know, action filmmakers are actually very good storytellers. They're just telling, you know, different types of stories, or stories in different ways, you know. And I think that if you do look at that, I mean, it works really well. There have been many times where, just because of the admiration for the craft, regardless of what's going on in the rest of the story, I can kind of take this, kind of like it sounds, you need to take an episode of the original series of Mission Impossible and just say, like, okay, let's watch them perform this heist. Let's see the mechanics of it and how it works and everything like that. How are they going to get Felicity out of this warehouse or whatever it is in Germany?
They cut her hair.
Yeah, there are three of those, aren't there?
And
in fact, there are four of those, because we have that part where they try to rescue Felicity. Mm-hmm. We have the heist of the briefcase where they sting Philip Seymour Hoffman himself.
Yeah.
There, once things go bad, Tom Cruise has to escape from IMF itself, and then we have the finale. Wait, there's another one, isn't there? Because we go to Shanghai.
Yeah, there's the Shanghai thing.
You skipped the dangling and the...
No, that's the Vatican one.
They have to heist the rabbit's foot itself, and then in Shanghai, and then we have the actual finale of the attack.
I got it confused with two.
After the trade, yeah. So there's actually five episodes mm-hmm. of the TV show in this movie, which is better than either of the first two, where it had zero or perhaps one episode, yeah. You could argue.
Well, this is one of the things that... Three is the first time that they ever had anything other than Ethan Hunt doing everything.
Right, yes. Yeah.
which was so weird because I did not remember that they were like always a giant group of talented weirdos. But yes. Like when I was watching three, I was like, oh yeah, that was kind of a thing.
So and everybody had a job.
Yeah. I forgot about it.
And that was something that I was going to ask you about, Tisto. But before we do, let me just say that, yeah, in terms of there being more action in this than the other two, like I remember seeing a quote from Kurtzman and Orsi, I think prior to when this movie came out, when they were talking about how, you know, they being the screenwriters were sort of really big into making sure that this movie was well written. And they talked about how even though this movie has a lot of action in it, and it in fact has more action sequences than the first two movies put together, they wanted to be absolutely certain that all of the action sequences advanced the story or the characters or, you know, the plot or whatever in some manner.
Can you imagine? I mean, like 20 years ago, it would be absurd that that would be said.
Well,
because like,
unless
my God,
you were talking about a musical, in which case they would say every song has to advance the plot.
Right. Yeah,
but this doesn't the idea even happen that in Singing in the Rain.
The idea that you have to point out, no, we're going to try to make our action sequences matter.
Right,
it's so sad.
But that's the nature of
so sad.
It's the nature of the.
We're going to try to hit that minimum quality level. We're going to clear that bar. We're gonna make it not utter nonsense.
But I think they succeeded.
Oh yeah, they did.
But regardless,
they cleared that bar.
Regardless of that,
they are not the worst thing possible.
Now, Tisto, getting back to what we were just talking about a second ago, do you feel that, you know, with the inclusion of the larger team and everything like that, and the heists being presented in the way that they are, that this is, at least up until this point, the closest version of Mission Impossible to the original series out of the movies?
To be sure, yeah. Especially the Vatican sting, where it really becomes a procedural of we're watching them accomplish this little bit where they get the briefcase and make off with it. That's plays beautifully against the TV show, yeah.
Okay.
It's like Ghost Protocol, though, so that's pretty cool.
I was going to say Ghost Protocol too.
All right. One last thing. It should be noted that due to the fact that Mission Impossible 3, in a lot of ways, was one of the factors which got Abrams the job on Star Trek, and the fact that this was his first movie and the crew that he assembled seemed to gel together really well, there are tons of people who worked on Mission Impossible 3 who would then go on to work on the two new movies.
Star Trek movies.
Star Trek movies, yes. Kurtzman and Orsi, obviously, were the writers. Dan Mindell, who did the cinematography, he shot all of J.J.'s movies, including the Star Wars Episode 7. And he shot the Star Trek movies as well. Scott Chambliss, the production designer, who actually came from Alias. Mary Jo Markey and Marianne Brandon, the two editors, who also came from Alias. Michael Giacchino came from Alias, too.
The music, yeah.
Anyway, so Tisto, any final thoughts on Mission Impossible 3?
I admire the way that J.J. Abrams has committed himself to looking like a racer head.
Okay, fair enough. Oh. What about you, Max?
I mean, like, my main problem with this movie is that it's kind of disposable. I mean, it's basic, it's an action movie. I mean, I would say that it's better than Expendables, but, yeah, that's it.
Okay. For my final thoughts, I guess I would just say that I do love this movie. In a lot of ways, I think that it's superior to Star Trek '09. Although I do think Star Trek '09 is the better movie, but I really responded to it for all the reasons that I mentioned before. But definitely would recommend this movie. All right. So, Tisto, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me over at Tisto, TYSTO.com.
Cool. And be sure to head over there to check out some stuff. And Mission Impossible commentaries. You can listen to a commentary for this movie probably in a few weeks, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, this
and
was
you're
fun.
Welcome back anytime.
Cool, Ben.
Well, it's been fun talking to Tisto about Mission Impossible 3, but that's not the only thing we're talking about on Trek FM this week. Here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Everything that we do has to exist inside of this little box.
This window,
yeah,
if you will.
Right. And you can do whatever you want inside there, but once you step outside, you know, it's the real world.
Earl Grey.
That's, you know what I mean? And then Star Trek V is all about crapping all over the rest of the movies that just came out.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When you're in the edit bay, as soon as you put one image next to another, it's this instant gratification. It's this great creative jolt, which happens every time you start juxtaposing your images. And when you start seeing things fall into place, it's really galvanizing and it's really thrilling, actually. And I love feeding off that kind of energy.
The Ready Room.
Well, you know, time is not really linear, Char. So the monkey, he's always been there and he always will be.
I take the Janeway stance on time travel. It gives me a headache.
The Orb.
Batman also creates a contingency plan for all the other superheroes just in case something goes wrong with them. So
what does he do for the Wonder Twins, for example? Like, how is he going to take them out?
I think he just separates them internally so they can't smack their hands together.
To the journey! We have like a whole bunch of geek aliens, like they're wearing their own superhero t-shirts, they're eating Hot Pockets, they have headphones on, and they're all in their own little, you know, 24th century room, but they're like, dude, I totally just pwned the Voyager. Commentary, Trek Stars.
And underlines the goal of Prexy Gail Berman to re-energize the pipeline while revitalizing the PAR brand with top-tier talent such as Abrams. I love trains.
You have
They're
no idea
so...
what you're saying at this point.
Warp 5.
He can put her mind at ease about these kinds of things because he can just, you know how Trip is. Like, let's have some catfish and, like, just hang out. You know,
I was just thinking that.
Continuing mission.
We actually spoke with CBS legal team, and that was one of the things that we had told them, is that all of our visuals were all original scenes. All of our animation was going to be original. All of our music would be original. So we would not be stealing any content from the original era. Mm-hmm. And they liked that a lot.
Literary Treks.
And I just love that because it is very true. You know, Picard in some ways kind of has that Yoda-ness about him where he will kind of speak in a riddle and he wants you to figure it out.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows to get in on the Daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox and Zune, or you can stream them from the website. Just visit trek.fm for a podcast directory to get all the links. So we have a new review today on iTunes. It's from Etten Skivel, I think is how you pronounce it, or maybe it's Et and Skivel. I don't know. Anyway, Etten Skivel. They write, an actual resource. They say, while I've only recently found Trek.fm, I've found Commentary Trek Stars to be a resource for our homeschool experience. I didn't even know Tabletop existed before Mike and Max discussed it. Now we own Ticket to Ride as a U.S. geography resource. Thanks, and keep up the good work. Well, thanks, Etten Skivel. We really do appreciate the feedback. It's kind of terrifying to think that we're being used as a resource to teach the youth of America. Perhaps we need to step up our game a bit more because that's a little too much responsibility for us to handle. But hopefully we haven't scarred your children too much. And thanks again. We really do appreciate the review. And now Etten Skivel here. You know, they've got it going on because since they reviewed us on iTunes, they're going to be entered into our drawing for some of these prizes that we have coming up on August 17th. For those people who don't know, we're having a review promotion right now going on Trek FM, where if you go to iTunes or Stitcher. You can leave a review for any or all of our podcasts, and for each review, you will be entered into a drawing to win some really cool Star Trek prizes. You know, you could win a season of Star Trek on DVD or Blu-ray of your choice. You could win one of the little Eagle Moss ships from Japan, complete with an authentic Japanese magazine. You could win a set of our alien art prints or badges from Trek FM that Toba Ushi did. Or now, if you review the Axanar podcast, you could win a set of three beautiful embroidered patches, compliments of Alec Peters, the creator of Axanar. And the deadline has been extended to Sunday, August 17th, so there's still time to place your entry into the contest. So here's the thing. Here's what you do, right? You review the show or any of the shows in iTunes and or Stitcher. You can also review the master feed. That counts as an entry, even if you've reviewed all the other shows. Each review will get you an entry into the drawing. So what you do is after you give us the review on iTunes or Stitcher, then you go to www.trek.fm/review, and you complete the form there. Okay. The deadline is midnight Pacific time on Sunday, August 17th. So be sure to enter, and may the odds be forever in your favor, or whatever they say in Hunger Games. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps bring us commentary Trek Stars to you each and every week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week, from classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Federation. Audible has something for everyone. They've even got Tom Cruise, an unauthorized biography by Andrew Morton. It's narrated by John Hinch, and it says, in 2006, Forbes magazine ranked Tom Cruise as the most powerful celebrity in the world. That's the year that Mission Impossible 3 came out. With 3 Golden Globe Awards, 3 Academy Award nominations, and 27 films with an average box office gross of nearly $100 million, People magazine's choice for the sexiest man alive in 1990 is unquestionably one of the biggest movie stars of our time. And you can get this book for free on Audible since you listen to Trek FM. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read, and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. And lastly, there's one more way you can directly help us keep Commentary, Trek Stars coming to you each week, and that is by adopting some aliens. Well, illustrations anyway. If you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find 8 original alien illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork you see on our website. They're available as both badges and art prints, and there are different contribution levels for you to choose from. Just let us know which you would like and in which format. Again, you'll find them at trek.fm/donate, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. As always, you can find us right here on Trek.fm doing Commentary Trek Stars, and you can also find me on Trek.fm doing Standard Orbit with Drew, and you can find both of us on our website, CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we do Commentary Trek Stars Off Topic with Brandon, and you can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com. Or you can find us on Twitter, at ComTrackStars. Well, that's it for Mission Impossible 3. We'll be back next week to discuss J.J. Abrams' third movie, Super 8.